As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance On Demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App. In the equity space, we heard it from the technical analysis giant Ralph Ancampora, Edward Yardeni of Yale, C.J. Lawrence is his own shop, on top of it, get into the stock market in October of last year. And on the economic side of Y equals C plus I plus G plus NX was Neil Dutta, very lonely at Renaissance Macro a year ago. We're really coming on a year ago, Neil, from your Arch call. Let's review. What did you see in September of 2022?
Well, thanks for that intro, Tom. You always make me look better than I actually do.
Yeah, we try.
So I appreciate it. But, I think it boiled down to something very simple, which is wage inflation was hanging in there while price inflation was coming down. I mean, that was the principal risk to the economy in the spring of 2022. You had a very aggressive Fed. You had rising food and energy prices that shocked household incomes. Due to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Of course, as we got towards the end of the year, a lot of that shock had gone away while the labor markets were still kind of hanging in there. So real incomes were climbing. And that meant stronger consumer spending ultimately. And that's why the economy sort of there. And of course, remember early in the year, Tom, everyone was betting on a Fed pivot. And we saw a very, we saw a modest decline in mortgage rates as a result of that. But that modest drop elicited a fairly robust response in housing market activity. So there's a lot of pent-up demand there for housing. And so I think, when housing is working, it's difficult to be very bearish on the economy.
If we have disinflation or leveling of inflation, what does nominal GDP do? Because top-line GDP, your real GDP optimism with whatever inflation is, linked into revenues of corporations. What's the Dutta nominal GDP call?
I mean, it's at least 6%.
Wow.
I mean, if you believe the last employment report, when you look at aggregate weekly income, aggregate weekly payroll, sort of the sum product of jobs, hours, and earnings. Over the last 3 months, that number is up 7% at an annual rate. So, the labor market sort of impulse for nominal growth is quite strong as well. So we have an unsustainably strong economy still. And this is happening at a time when the Fed is taking, steps to the exit door. To me, I think the risk, and this is what I think makes me not an optimist, is that the risk is that, the Fed is prematurely declaring victory. I do see a lot of cyclical momentum in the economy right now, and the Fed stepping back. I think that could set us up for a problem as we go into 2024.
Neil, the fact that you said an unsustainably hot economy, an unsustainable level of growth in the U.S. raises this real question. What's going to make it unsustainable? Is it the inflation story that you see as resurging? We've talked about this before. And the fact that the Fed's not there, or is it just that you cannot continue in a vacuum? So at some point, it's going to implode on itself.
Well, I don't know that it'll implode on itself without the Fed doing something about it. And of course, the problems for markets are always when there's a disconnect between what the Fed wants to do and what they should do. That's when the problems come up. And, I think the Fed should not be signaling rate cuts next year. I mean, that to me is a bare, that's like a easy first thing that they should do is not signal rate cuts. They need to maintain a tight monetary stance because, frankly, real GDP growth is running, last I checked, 6% at an annual rate over the last 3 months. Now, you can talk about revisions. You can talk about, you know, that's not where the underlying growth rate is. But if you look at monthly GDP as of July, over the last 3 months, ending in July, it's up 6% at an annual rate. I know that's not the underlying trend, but it's above trend growth.
Well, and this is the reason why a lot of people are talking about the same thing that you are. We heard from Katie Kaminsky over at Alpha Simplex basically saying the same thing that you are in different ways. And she's bearish on bonds because she sees this coming to the fore and yields having to remain higher for longer. There is a question, though, embedded in Goldman Sachs's discussion of the long and variable lags. And maybe this is an economy that can shrug off a 5% Fed funds rate and it's not going to matter. So at what point do you see higher bond yields as not inconsistent with higher stock prices, with higher valuations, with a continued rally in the equity market?
Well, I mean, I think right now the combination is reasonably good for stocks, right? Because the Fed is backing off and you have strong growth. And that's you know, so the Fed's sort of off your neck, I think, at least through the end of the year. I mean, if they're going to hike again, it'll probably be in December. So I don't really think we have to worry about the Fed until then. And this is happening at a time when there's cyclical momentum in the economy. The fact is that goods spending, consumer spending on goods, is up over 3% against last year. And during that time, non-farm inventories have been contracting around 0.5 percentage point on average per quarter. Again, that's an unsustainable drawdown in inventory. So what are you going to see? You're going to see inventories restock. That's going to buoy manufacturing production. Again, cyclical industries. So that should be good for equities. The question is, when does the Fed wake up and realize that long and variable lags are not working out as neat and cleanly as they have in their in the Ferbus model?
Based on the 6% concept,
they may have to step on the brakes even more so.
What does that mean, right? And that's exactly where I was going to go. How high do rates have to go in order to curtail some of what you see as unsustainable growth in the U.S.?
I mean, I think that you need to keep the possibility on there for them to start to hike again in the first half of next year. At a minimum, they're going to price. I mean, I think they have 4 rate cuts priced into the summary of economic projections right now. It's hard to see that surviving in September. So, I think let's start there.
Neil, in the economics textbook, chapter 23 or 24 links all of his econobabble into the stock market. Take the Dutta optimism and the corporations are going to have to deal with an improved real rate. They're going to have to deal with a high nominal rate, about 3 years, 5 years of well. How does the stock market respond to that? How does the stock market react to an overweighted, optimistic Dutta world?
Well, so I think you could call it sort of an inflationary boom. I think that might be what we're returning to. And if that's the case, that's an environment where stocks can work. It's unambiguously bad for bonds. But for stocks, I think it's an environment where you should see continued positive returns, maybe not, somewhat below the historical norm. Obviously, if you have higher real interest rates, that hurts equities. But if you have continued growth in the economy, that means that actual earnings and projected earnings will hang in there. So
just because of time, I got to get this in. How is an inflationary boom different now from the horror of the 60s?
Well, that was obvious. Well, the horrors of the 60s. I mean, the 60s were a reasonably good period for stock market returns and the economy. An inflationary boom, again, as I say, is something that where equities can work. What you don't want is stagflation-like conditions where productivity is coming down, where you have repeated supply shocks. That's an environment where bond returns are horrible, but stock returns are as well, because companies can't find a way to make money in that environment.
Neil, your Q4 GDP number right now. We got to get Brammo going. What's your Q4 real GDP number?
I mean, we're running so strong right now. I mean, but I think we probably slow to something like 2.5 in Q4. I think what the consensus is missing right now is that we're going to have a very robust inventory restocking on our hands That's going to bleed into measures of factory activity.
Neil Dauta, congratulations on your economic work. He's with the Renaissance Macro Research as well.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Katie Kaminsky, Chief Research Strategist at Alpha Simplex, joins us now. Katie, short question just to open up. Are you still short the Treasury market?
Yes.
436 didn't get it done for
come
you.
Come on. First time guest.
Hey,
you got to go longer,
Katie. No. There is a follow-up. It's okay.
Please,
we welcome short answers. Katie, let's elaborate on that. We saw 436 on a 10-year. We got back to 5.1% on a 2-year. What exactly are you looking for? Why is the juice worth the squeeze?
Well, I love that you asked this because everyone keeps saying, let's be bullish the bond market, but look at the price. Look at the price all summer. It has continued to go up in yield. So yields, even though they pulled back last week, they continued on Friday and they're continuing today. And what we're seeing is we need to see a flatter yield curve, and everyone's really ready for there to be a pause. And there's probably a pause, but I think it's going to take a while before we see a flatter yield curve and before we see a situation where inflation has come down. Thus, we're going to see higher yields for a little bit longer.
What does it mean to be bearish at a time where yields are jumping all over the place? Are you outright short or are you just not buying the stuff?
So in the futures markets, the technical signals have been outright short for 2 years. And that sounds interesting, but it really means that they're, in some sense, in contrast to what you would think about most fundamental traders have been thinking about the bond market. But we've started to see a lot of fundamental traders as well saying that they're also short the bond market, which means that they're shorting bonds, expecting that we're going to need to see a flatter yield curve, that we're going to need to see a higher yield return on longer term debt. And this makes sense because maybe we need a duration premium back in the curve for the short term.
When people ask you for some sort of fundamental explanation for why longer-term bond yields will remain high, pointing to the idea that we're probably going to go back to some sort of normal that we saw pre-pandemic of slow growth and slow inflation, what do you say? Is it just technical? Is it foreign buying? Is it something about just the debt load of this nation?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think it's a combination of either a preference for holding that long-term debt, either as a hedge for potential deterioration in financial conditions, a view that we could have rate cuts faster than they might occur, is the two common ones I'm thinking about. So a lot of people are thinking, well, hey, things look good. The Fed's going to come in and cut. But my concern is that they think that, but now it's looking like it was originally going to be 2023. Now they're saying 2024. Who knows when it's going to be 2025? My view is that we're going to take time to get to that point with the Fed, and thus interest rates have to stay higher for longer. And if you're going to hold a long-term bond, you need to have that duration premium over the shorter-term return of holding shorter-term debt. So in that sense, it's a fundamental view in that sense.
Katie, that might be an argument for why yields should stay high. What's the argument for why they will be higher?
So why they will be higher is that I think that it's not priced in that it could take longer to get to cuts. And so people are assuming that, you know, things are going to go back to normal and thus shorter term rates will go down and we'll have a healthier curve. But if, in fact, they have to stay higher for longer in the short end, that means that longer term rates have to go up. And it's a simple question when people start to realize, wait a minute, I'm getting 5-something% for 2 years. If I'm going to hold something for 10, maybe I want a little bit more.
Catherine, let's talk trending. Let's talk Katie on the great giant Wells Wilder. If I look at Brent crude, I have a nascent uptrend like I had 3-4 years ago as well. On ADX-DMI, on parabolic SAR, on exponential climb and moving averages, is Brent crude trending higher?
Yes. And that's the biggest thing we've been focusing on. So if we want to connect this inflation story, the thing we're watching is the oil market, because we're looking for catalysts, something that might give us another wave of uptick for upside risk in the inflation numbers. Those are the things that are going to cause the Fed to be more cautious. And also, we're seeing signs of that outside the U.S. Of course, we saw some. Yeah, exactly.
Katie, come on. It's the beginning of the year, the beginning of the business year. What's your point figure target on Brent crude right now? Over 100?
I don't have the exact number, but we're definitely seeing that's one of the biggest growing trends in terms of our signals. The signal strength for Brent crude has been one that's been ticking up lately. It did revert a little bit in August based on some data on China and other, the dollar also weakening a little bit. So we started to see some dollar strength, dollar weakening messing with some of that trend. But in general, that has been the trend to watch more recently. And the reason that is important is because that is one of the indicators, at least when we've seen inflation data down the pipeline. Brent crude has been one, for example, in 2022, that tends to be something to follow as a catalyst into where you start to see inflation numbers tick up later in the year.
Katie, thank you for the update. Katie Kaminski there of Alpha Simplex on a bond market.
We're going to be complete right now with Wendy Schiller, director of the Taubman Center of American Politics and Policy at Brown, truly one of our most popular guests. We get huge response when she's on. Wendy, let's go to the images that we saw on radio. It was the president doing what he does, marching around with a mic, baseball cap on, hearkening to a union that he knew in eastern Pennsylvania long ago and far away. Don't they vote for Trump now?
Well, there's a lot of mixed voting in terms of unions, right? So if you think about the Teamsters, for example, they lean a little bit more Republican in their voting, but a lot of other private unions, particularly in the local level, vote for Democrats because they believe Democrats will spend money on things like infrastructure, which means construction, which means jobs for them. So it depends on the sort of local balance on where the jobs are in terms of private unions. You're absolutely right. About 7%, a little over 7% of the private sector is unionized, but public sector is still in the 30s in terms of unionization. And that can really matter in some of these key swing states. When Republicans go after unions, go after labor, they go after public employee unions, you know, that can cost them votes. So Biden's sort of skirting the line, private labor, but also public labor unions are very important coming down to the election.
Politically, do you see a rekindling or rejuvenation of unions moving from that 7% statistic higher, or is that just wishful thinking on the part of union types?
Well, I think there seems to be a concerted strategic effort for unions to branch out things like college campuses, for example, unionizing undergraduates, unionizing graduate students. You may think, oh, well, that may not matter on the margins. However, that's a group that is still really ripe for picking in terms of votes. And it's certainly a group that the Democrats need more than the Republicans to get out the door. So every time you have a new union agreement or a new people coming into the union sphere, you know, that's a pretty much guaranteed vote because unions are excellent still at getting out their base to vote.
Wendy, it seems like yesterday's speech did a number of things. It did highlight the union membership. It also highlighted the fact that there has been more union action recently. Without the strikes, that could potentially be a liability. But this is also what Biden said. We're turning things around because of you. When the last guy was here, you were shipping jobs to China. Now we're bringing jobs home from China. How much is President Biden trying to galvanize his campaign by going after former President Trump with the assumption that he will be the person he's facing off?
Well, Lisa, I would argue he hasn't done that enough yet. And also, just to show Biden out on the trail, you know, he can walk, he can talk, he's clear, he was energetic. I mean, you know, given the most recent polling that has people really doubting his age and doubting his capability, the more he can get out and show that he's still vibrant, you know, the more he can mitigate those kinds of concerns. So I think that's a really important part of this strategy. And also, if you think about some of the things in the most recent polling about Trump's job performance in office, it's relatively positive. So, you know, the COVID after effect, which some people argue cost Trump the presidency in 2020, that seems to be diminishing for Trump. So, you know, absent the indictments, there might be a rosier glow on how Trump's presidency went among average voters or independent voters. That's a real concern for the Democrats, a real concern for Biden. He's got to remind people of what that administration really was like and why they rejected it in 2020.
Does President Biden have any chance of winning if he's not facing off with the former President Trump?
Lisa, that is, you know, that is the Republican Party's existential question. You have to believe that the negatives associated with Trump, particularly among independent voters in swing states, and remember, some of these swing states have swung a little more to the Democrats in recent elections, at least at the gubernatorial level and the Senate level. And when you think about that, that's their issue. You know, would they do much better if Nikki Haley was the head of the ticket, or even Ron DeSantis, even if he looks shaky, or even Tim Scott? I'm not sure if Vivek Ramaswamy is the guy to go to. So of Trump light, so I'm not sure that does it for them. But if they didn't have the liability of Trump, would they be doing and polling much more strongly among independents than they are now?
Professor Schiller, Jeff Stein with the article of the weekend on the nation's deficit, again, burgeoning out X number of trillion. Everett Dirksen and I have lost track of the billions and trillions. Is the debt of concern to an academic like you, or is it just the usual debt angst, not understanding the mass, the size, the scale of America?
Well, I think the parties have long abandoned really seriously worrying about the debt, the Republicans and the Democrats, all the Republicans use it. I think solving the debt limit crisis, I think that was, as we saw, something that both parties understood they had to finish and had to get done. But you'll see this rhetoric, Tom, absolutely in the next 4 weeks by the Republican Party. They're going to claim we spend too much money. They're going to want big cuts, and Biden's going to have to hold the line, which may lead to a government shutdown a couple of days after the second Republican Party debate. And that hurts in the end of the day. It hurts Biden in a lot of ways because he's the incumbent and because the incumbent's supposed to run the government smoothly. If you couple that with another strike, another union strike, if we see the auto worker strike, I think that creates real uncertainty and concern among voters about the Biden administration. So it's a real risk for them.
Wendy Schiller of Brown University.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Right now, we're going to burst into tears with David Rubenstein. He joins us, of course, of the Carlyle Group, his philanthropy, including completely stacking the Duke football. We have to stop the show after talking to guard Jay Pulaski. Duke 28, Clemson 7. How did you contribute to this win?
I was calling the signals in from the sidelines.
And
people didn't know
with
that.
Your
I
support
had little hand
Duke.
Signals.
Yeah.
That's what Duke did. If they'd listened to my hand signals earlier, they would have been a better team all along, but they just started listening to them.
Is this Rubenstein making Duke football a new D1 resurgent story?
It's great. We haven't had victory as big as this in quite
some
time.
What kind of hand signals? Like, woo!
Yeah, well, that's how Coach K won all of his championships. I would send in hand signals from the sidelines. He didn't want to tell people that.
Yeah. David Rubenstein, Jeremy Grantham. I know Jeremy for ages. I have a huge respect for him and his philanthropy. speaks volumes. In your conversation with Mr. Grantham, how did you address the four-year caution he's had on the American financial experiment?
For those who don't know, Jeremy Grantham is a man who is a very distinguished an analyst, financial analyst, and he's been quite prescient in predicting bubbles bursting. And he's really good at that. And he's predicted many bubbles that have that actually subsequently burst. As a result, he's got a really terrific record as an investor. But now he's spending most of his time investing in climate change and climate tech. He thinks the greatest challenge in the world now is the climate problem we have. So most of his money is in a foundation that goes towards that. But he likes to call bubbles, and he's said maybe artificial intelligence is a mini bubble. But we're now coming out of the tech bubble, and that tech bubble he forecast, and he was not involved in tech, and therefore he did pretty well for his investors. He built GMO many years ago. He's a British citizen initially, but lived in the United States after Harvard Business School. And he built one of the better money management firms in the Boston area. And he's quite well known for his philanthropy, but also for predicting bubbles. And he also says the Fed is almost always wrong in predicting recessions. The Fed is not predicting recession now, but he thinks we will have a recession for sure.
Does he think that it's harder to see a bubble now than in the past? Is it more difficult to spot bubbles in an era where people have been grown up, have been raised through the financial crisis and through the Big Short and all the glory around bubbles?
Well, you don't really know you're in a bubble till it bursts, typically. And he's actually pretty good at predicting bubbles, but nobody's perfect at it. And the reason we have bubbles, he would say, is that there's the phenomenon that everybody is afraid that their neighbor's going to get rich and they're going to miss out on it. So they pile in when things keep going up, and ultimately, in a burst, they're disappointed. Pointed out, for example, Sir Isaac Newton, one of the smartest men ever, he got into an investment, thought it was pretty good, doubled his money, got out, and then he saw it kept going up and up. So he mortgaged his house, took all of his money, put it back in, and he lost it everything. He went bankrupt.
Physics and market timing maybe don't go exactly together all the time. I'll just say that.
Right.
But there is this question going forward, especially at a time where people are trying to game out where the Fed is, of just the cross currents and the uncertainties and how much the U.S. can continue to diverge from other places. Does he seem to think that that's overplayed based on the AI bet, that sort of people are not looking at history and that they need to more to really understand this?
Well, I think looking at history would be something he thinks is a good idea, because if you look at history, you'll see that when you have these kind of inflated bubbles, they're inevitably going to burst. And so we've had many bursts. The dot-com bubble is where he really made his name, because he was, in effect, predicting that would happen in 1998, 1999, and 2000. And his firm did quite well avoiding the tech bubble that existed then. He's actually a legendarily smart person about predicting follies of the markets. And he's not afraid of telling you that you're not smart, you're stupid, you're doing something wrong. He's not afraid of actually going against the conventional wisdom. Very often people don't want to offend other people by telling them they're not that smart, but he's willing to say, you're wrong about this.
But this is why this conversation is so important, folks. 9 p.m. tonight, Rubenstein Grantham. David, you're one of the congenital optimists out there. You have put money where mouth is on the artifacts, the heritage of the American financial experiment, the Magna Carta purchase that you made, and the others. I'm not going to say you're the polar opposite of Mr. Grantham, but there's a built-in Rubenstein optimism. Do you maintain that even with the, not perma-bear, but the perpetual caution that we witness with Jeremy Grantham?
Well, he's much more bearish and much more negative on things than I am, personality-wise, probably. But, you know, that takes a lot of courage. When you're telling people they're wrong all the time, that's not easy to do. So I'm probably not as good at telling people they're wrong to their face as he is. But he's willing to tell people you're wrong and you're making a big mistake.
All of us rocked by the climate change stories of the summer, this, that, the other thing. What is his prescription to have America address facts of climate change?
Well, he thinks we're not doing enough, for sure. Now, he can't solve all that problem himself. But what he's doing is taking most of his money now and investing it in green tech companies, venture capital kind of companies, small ones, hoping that one thing will come along that will actually make a big difference. But he's not trying to influence our government policy by going down lobbying. He's past that. But he's actually a very, very clever person who now has made his main focus in life climate tech and investing in things that are going to maybe help with climate.
You've said several times he's not afraid to tell people to their face that they're wrong. Has he said that to you?
Well, he hasn't said to me I'm wrong, but necessarily. But I think generally, when you're predicting people, or you're predicting bubbles are going to burst, you're telling people, 90% of the people, they're wrong. And he's not afraid of telling people they're wrong. You got to have a certain kind of personality. Probably he's better at it than I would be.
The idea of investing in niche companies, sort of what Tom is talking about, whether it's climate change or whether it's some of the venture capital that other people are doing, is that a more sure bet from your point of view now at a time where there is such a high degree of uncertainty on a macro level?
Well, on climate tech?
Or just in general, broadly. Like this sort of niche concept of just going at things very specifically with a smaller pool of money, is that a sure bet to make bigger returns?
There's no sure bets anywhere, of course. I think the biggest concern that I would have is that we're not quite past the point where we know there's not going to be a recession. I don't think we will have a recession, but nobody knows for certain. You don't know it until you get into it. Right now, the conventional wisdom in Washington is that we've gone past the likelihood of a recession. And there are some people like Jeremy Grantham who thinks that we may have a recession, but it may be next year, not this year. As you know, there was a prediction of a hard landing, maybe by the end of this year. But now most people would say probably not going to have a hard landing by the end of this year. But as the next year, that's when Jeremy Grantham thinks there will be a recession, sometimes next year. And again, predicting recessions is a fool's errand. It's very difficult to do.
Dave, we've got time for one more question. It's really important. The quarterback for Duke is just totally irresponsible. He had late homework, and he had to do a whole video asking the professor to delay his, you know, to get his homework in so he'd get a quality C. Riley Leonard of Duke University. I mean, is he destined for a Carlisle internship? I mean, where are we on this?
He's
I need to make some news today. Help me.
Well, I think in college football and college basketball today, you can make more money playing college basketball and college football than going to private equity firm.
What did you think of the Citadel internship? The salaries they're getting? Did you see that last week? They're making ginormous money.
Well, Citadel is a great firm, and it's got a great leader, and they're making a lot of money, and I guess they're paying out a lot of money. They want to get really smart people, and they can pay up for it.
But this, what was your first internship in finance? You walked in the door and said, I'm just glad, can I get you?
I didn't have an internship in finance. I think my first job was probably selling magazines door-to-door or something like that, but I didn't have a finance internship, really.
David Rubenstein here. Riley Leonard, if you're listening this morning, call 1-800-Rubenstein and you get that Carlisle internship going. Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.